Off the Ball Rugby.
This is a big opportunity now for him to silence a lot of critics going into the summer with a bit of a bounce in his step, going to the Irish Tour with some confidence built up, and you know, really grab that jersey.
Join in the obsession. Subscribe now at offtheball.com/join.
Salut, ça va? Welcome. We'll talk about Thursday's main stories in just a second. And Matt Slater of The Athletic will be on, talking about Crystal Palace, who won the FA Cup, qualified for Europa League, but may not get to play in it next season. We'll talk about that and, of course, the imminent Club World Cup, which starts on Sunday. So this is basically a conversation about the state of modern football. Ciara Trant, the Dublin All-Star goalkeeper, legendary figure in the GAA circles in Dublin, will talk the Women's Gaelic Football Championship this weekend, as well as the Men's. And then Pat Daly, who is a legend of the administrative game in the GAA. He worked full-time in the organisation for 44 years, complete trailblazer in the field, set up the goal games, along with other many very, very game-changing initiatives in the GAA, and he'll be doing his very eclectic You Had to Be There. Welcome, welcome, welcome. It's Thursday the 12th of June on Off the Ball Breakfast. You can catch us on YouTube. Type in Off the Ball. You'll see that we're live. Click in and you'll see four of us in front of you. Or WhatsApp us 0879 180 180. If you look back at the genealogy of his clan, you will surely find a family full of post men and women alike, because this guy always delivers. It's Arthur O'Dea. Sligo. Good morning. You know what? And you're probably asking yourself, well, what's better than a representative of a great jewel county? Two representatives. So welcome, welcome, welcome. Off the Ball's latest Corkonian, Rachel Sheehan. Rachel, good morning.
Good morning, Colin.
And back by very popular demand to guest co-host Off the Ball Breakfast once more, it's Galway's finest, Megan Scully. Megan, good morning.
Grimmie Lavaga, thanks for having me back.
What the hell happened there last Sunday in the Leinster final?
Do you know what, Arthur and
you
I
were so confident about this.
Was I though?
So confident.
I don't know if I was now. I think after watching the Munster final the evening before and all that came out of that, and just how nail-biting and exhilarating and stressful and sweat-inducing and heart palpitations that were brought on. And then the next day, I was even saying this to you, I kind of struggled to even keep my eye on the television. And it just seemed that Kilkenny were doing what Kilkenny do and were just kind of playing their own game. And then they kind of, I guess, lost a bit of momentum for, a couple of minutes. Galway got some great scores in, and then suddenly Kilkenny were like, well, hold on a second now. What's happening here? And then they just went up another gear again. And it just was hard to watch because I don't know, is there like a disconnect at the moment in the Galway squad, or what's going on? And like, they have some unbelievable players there. Like, you look at the whole squad, and young and old, and they've got a really good mix of seasoned players and kind of younger players getting a chance to play. But it just, I don't know. I know we hear this a lot, but people talking about the whole Leinster, I guess, versus Munster. But like, so you watch Munster and it's just every time you watch a Munster championship game, it's so exciting. And then, yeah, I don't know what the resolve is in it. But look, Micheál Donoghue is there for a few years and there is a game plan. So maybe, you know, I did hear, I think Fintan Burke was on an interview before the game, and he was saying that there is a kind of a building going on, a rebuild going on, I guess, and that some of the players are kind of still gelling and getting to know each other. So I think maybe there is, you know, look, it's part of the process of just getting to the next stage. But maybe, is that a 2-3 year plan?
Yeah. I spoke to Fintan Burke at the launch of the hurling at the Faithful Fields on Tuesday, and he didn't seem too concerned. You know, he said it was a disappointing Leinster final for Galway, obviously, but he said the fact that they rallied for 12, 13 minutes, if they can manage to do that, even for, obviously, you'd be hoping to do it for 70.
Yeah.
But he didn't seem as concerned as everybody else about the state of Galway hurling. So
that's it, yeah. And that's kind of the way I think it is, that they're kind of all looking at it as this kind of rebuild, and they all, I guess, you know, they still have another chance. But that's the other thing too with Galway, like, they could come back and surprise us. You just never know. Because like that, when they kind of are on form, they are incredible. And those few scores they got in those few minutes you mentioned, like at one stage I was going, oh, hold on a second now. Hold on, things are changing. And, you know, you're kind of getting up off the sofa. But look, it wasn't their day. Like, Kilkenny just showed again what Kilkenny can do.
Oh, yeah. Well, they're still living off the fumes of 2017, aren't they? Galway with the same manager, some of the same players still there 8 years later. But look, what about the hurlers? Is there more excitement about the men's footballers and the men's side of the game now?
I mean, I'm still holding on to 98 now again here. I'm still rallying for that.
There's Armagh this weekend.
Yeah, I know. And like a repeat of last year. And I think there's great excitement around this game because, again, Armagh and Galway. And I just love that now we have Galway. We talk about Galway footballers in this context where it's like we are one of the top teams. And there's great excitement around the Galway footballers. And I know we mentioned last week, you were talking about the dual county. And, you know, I think, as I was saying to you, football and hurling are starting to kind of move across the county now. We're seeing more hurling teams over in Connemara. We're seeing more football teams coming down to our side of the county as well. And I think everyone now, the whole county is really getting behind the footballers as well, because the last few years they've been knocking on that door. And like, the, I guess the grow for Pádraig Joyce is just something else. Like, everyone is just absolutely mad about him.
Yeah.
And I think what he brings to the team as well, and this squad, like, that's where I feel like there's a really good connection with the footballers. You can see that kind of camaraderie. You can see that, like, want to help each other, want to will each other on. You can see that real kind of, I guess, support for each other on the pitch. And yeah, it's just a very exciting time. Like, I mean, Dual County, it doesn't get much better than being from Galway.
Well, it's Cork really actually is the answer, because Cork is still officially the greatest Dual County in the country. Still officially, no one's beaten that record 35 years on. Whatever about our hurlers, like, what hope do we have for the men's footballers at the moment? It's been Roscommon this weekend. I'd be asked about it every so often as the representative of Cork for us, Rachel.
And I'm just like, spokesperson
a lot of shrugging and general apathy about Cork football, for the men's side anyway, across the county. But specific parts of Cork are actually very into it and get very annoyed when you say that. But we're kind of in no man's land.
We are. And it just seems to be a bit of a team that will play very well against Kerry for the first round.
Why can we manage to do that? And then against Meath we get hockeyed.
Yeah. Are we just fueled by bitterness? I don't know. It's just maybe, we can't let them get away with it, but they've put in some savage performances, and I'm hoping, you know, with the way the new rules are going, like, we have shooters on that team, you know, if anything else. So if we can start knocking off those two pointers like we did against Kerry. But I think we'll win on the weekend.
Where's Sligo going?
What do you mean?
What's the direction? The KPIs? Play. 5-year plan.
Play for Manor this weekend, and here we go. Quarterfinal of the Talgeon Cup.
Cards kept close to the chest there. Doesn't want to give anything away.
No, it's been fine. It's been an okay year.
Yeah.
Haven't been playing particularly well, but kind of getting job done. Got past Carlow at the weekend. Fermanagh, Brewster Park this weekend. Different story. But they'll probably, like, a semi-final of the Talgeon Cup should be Sligo's base. Probably. Mm. Or certainly has been. So you'd kind of go, like, hopefully. I think they drew in the league. So, like, hopefully win this weekend. The hurling's gone backwards altogether.
No.
Yeah. But that's what happens at that level. Like, it's amazing, because it just takes a few people. Like, Sligo, like, I know it was seen as the nadir of Offaly hurling to be playing Sligo, and Michael Dyson was saying as much to us when he was on. Like, Offaly hammered Sligo in Markovic Park in the Christy Ring a few years ago. That was obviously their low point, but it was an incredible high point for Sligo. But, like, it's incredible that it just takes, that was a product of the team, but, like, a few different people who came into the county and just vitalised everything. So it's just a case all of a sudden. And you can make such, I feel at that level particularly, you can make such gains with just a few people involved. Now, going up, even you look at Kildare, like, in a relative thing, get into the Leinster Championship.
Yeah.
And it's just like, it's a few little tweaks, and all of a sudden, you're going higher than you've ever been. But it's hard then to kick on. Like, so then, obviously, when those are pulled out and things go backward again, so we've had a bit of a disastrous year in the hurling front. But,
be amazing if a county did nail doing dual properly.
I mean, they can only just learn from the best.
Yeah, like, if Dublin can't do it, why are Dublin
not unbelievable at hurling? And people who say, stop playing that much. Like, where I live, I can't move for people playing hurling. I look left and right, and people are playing it everywhere.
Yeah, and I suppose, like, how many clubs are up here? It's just phenomenal, and I guess so many people that have moved, either their parents moved up here, or else they've moved up for work, and, you know, we know so many different players that are kind of transferring and stuff. So you would think they'd be like there, thereabouts. But I think is it just the football is just so intertwined in Dublin?
Yeah, but the population, you know, there's room for two sports.
Yeah. You'd have to wonder, why is it not
as popular? It is a conundrum, honestly. I really don't know. I'd be talking to Dublin friends of mine, and I'd be like why aren't you better than Ireland? I don't get it. Anyway, the big news today, of course, is the start of the third major of the year. It's the US Open in Oakmont CC. So it's the first time it's in Oakmont CC since 2016. And this is an absolute nightmare of a course for the players to play on. If you shoot par here, you're doing quite well by all accounts. So the last time it happened in that venue, as I say, 9 years ago, 2016, Dustin Johnson won, and he was the peak of his powers then. But going into that final day that year, Shane Lowry was ahead by 4, and he blew it. But it was actually, in many ways, a huge achievement because only 7 days earlier, he practiced on that Sunday before that 2016 US Open and went back into the clubhouse a defeated man saying, there's no way I can play this course. And only because there was rain on the Wednesday and Thursday of that year in 2016 that he was able to compete. And he actually did compete in spectacular fashion right up until the end. Fast forward 9 years and little has changed there in terms of the conditions. There has been a bit of precipitation, but nothing that's going to be substantial and game changing. So this could be one of the highest scoring winning US Opens in a long, long time. Because it's actually not played in Oakmont that regularly at all. Yeah. They do the rounds. It's back again. I think Angel Cabrera won it the previous time in 2007. Ernie Els in 1994. So some of the greats of the game win this when it's here. And it'll be fascinating to see who's going to do it this year. Because you can't look beyond Scottie Scheffler.
I know, and everyone is talking about the course, and you mentioned there at Lowry, and he was saying, this is just too hard, and then he did what he did. But I was laughing there, you said, because there was rain. I was like, is that a real Irish thing, that the rain came down and it suited him? Is that just that we're so used to rain? But yeah, just looking at some of them out there, like, it just, and like everyone, and you, when I was looking up the course, like nobody has anything nice to say about it, really. Everyone's just like...
it's not enjoyable for them. Yeah, that's they just want to get through it.
They just don't enjoy it. So that's why I think what makes this one probably so interesting, because going into it, it's like, if they all are going on, oh God, we have to play here. You know, that's where you're kind of, like, how can you put like back someone? I know Scheffler, of course, is like the hot favourite. But even just looking at them going out there, and like DeChambeau as well, was he last year's winner? But where was it played last year? It was in
Pinehurst last year.
So you just have to, yeah, it's like one of those things that you just probably cannot call because of the conditions and what everyone says about it. Now, there is actually, I think, rain expected though today, isn't there? Or you said just precipitation.
Yeah, Soakmont, they called it that year. I loved that.
Mm. Yeah. Well, they'll actually really hope for it. Like, it is. It's a bizarre course. You see some really strange things happen at the US Open. I think they generously call it chaotic. So like the eighth hole is a par three. It's 289 yards. Nearly 300 yards for a par three is ridiculous. And then like you will frequently see players putting on fairways.
It's great.
Like
it's,
that's how quick it is. There's a story of a fella putting the marker down years ago and the marker rolled.
Oh, wow.
That's how quick. So the fairway is too fast and the rough is too high. So there's no let up. There's no reprieve in all 18 holes. Now, by all accounts, they've made the rough a little bit more playable, because I think it was just getting like a circus act. Like, it was a crazy golf. So they're trying to make it a little bit respectable, I suppose, in a respectable sport. But in terms of the contenders that we're interested in, like I mentioned, Lowry leading the last day 9 years ago. He did the same the weekend just gone at the Canadian Open, but he is actually playing well and certainly playing better than Rory McIlroy, who didn't make the cut in spectacular fashion at the Canadian Open. Finished on 9 over in a competition that he generally loves and is generous to him. But McIlroy seems to be not in the best shape 2 months after winning the Masters.
I don't know. I think like it'll suit him being written off going into it.
Mm.
And people keep saying that after he won the Grand Slam that he's nothing to play for. Sure, of course he does. You know, he lost this last year to Bryson DeChambeau in the most agonising fashion possible. Of course he'd like to come back and win it. And there's all the talk is about him not being able to focus. And like, of course he's going to be focused going in there. And it's such an unforgiving course. If anyone can go out and make mistake after mistake after mistake and recover, we've seen that. It's McIlroy. You know, he did it at the Masters. A lot of these players aren't used to, you know, they get a bogey, get a double bogey, and it's game over. But he's the master of that now. So I wouldn't be writing
him
off.
He's the master of it, yes. He is, absolutely. I don't know. I thought he'd be happier, basically, than he is. And Paul McGinley isn't happy with Rory McIlroy. I don't know what's going on here. Is there a bit of beef between, a historical beef between McGinley and McIlroy? I think there might be. This is from the Irish Independent back page this morning. So you have McIlroy there swinging away. But the context is quite interesting. Paul McGinley has described Rory McIlroy's pre-US Open press conference as, quote, very worrying, and expressed concern for the Hollywood star as he tries to reset his goals. I was very worried. It was very worrying looking at his press conference there. His eyes weren't alive. The energy was not there.
Wow.
Now I wouldn't be too happy if I was going through the motions in a press conference and people were dissecting every bit of body language that I excluded.
Is that not what people have been saying?
What?
That's not a unique take from McGinley, like.
Well, I don't know about the eyes not being alive and the energy not being there.
Well,
I would say the motivation hasn't been there, which McIlroy has spoke of. But I don't know if you can take that in a press conference and put it all together, being like, yeah, this guy clearly lacks motivation because of the way he's sitting. But that's what McGinley is looking into. And look, he had strange comments minutes after McIlroy won the Masters and then clarified them to see what he meant. You know, I didn't mean anything by that. But now I think we're back into that mode again. Like, I agree with you in the sense that people are talking about McIlroy in a more negative fashion at the moment, and strangely so, and we're all a bit confused as to why that's the case. But McInerney's going a bit deeper here in terms of body language.
I'm kind of going, like, that's kind of body language experts is stuff you read in the Daily Mail when celebrities are walking out of somewhere, you know. It's like, why are we doing that in golf? And also, how close was he sitting to him to see his eyes? I'm like, people could probably say that about me this morning, saying I have tired eyes and low energy. But like, it's just kind of like, how, like, I just think, is this, as you mentioned, like, all the articles seem to be a bit more on the negative aspects of McIlroy, and kind of it's almost like people forgot what he's achieved already. I think him going out with McIlroy, or with Lowry, I think is actually what we're all really excited for, because I feel like Shane Lowry has this almost like, I don't know, would you say like uncle kind of vibe with Rory McIlroy, where he kind of just takes him under his arm and looks after him and kind of is his like hype person as well. And I think
Lowry,
I think
tell him that,
but I just,
he hates that. He hates that. So the Saturday in the Masters, it was like, stop asking me about Rory, I'm trying to win this thing.
But like, I just think he's got such a good energy about him that I think he lifts everyone that's around him. Like, I feel like if you're around Lowry, I think you're just going to be in good form automatically. And I just feel like, I think we're all like looking forward to watching them going around together to see like what the, actually to see what the body language is like and what the energy is like. Mm. But I just think there's an awful lot of negative press around McIlroy. It's like, and as you mentioned though, I think he kind of almost, does that kind of go in his favour? Because it's like, well, look, I'm going to show all of you guys. And as mentioned, it's a difficult course. Rory McIlroy loves a good kind of, he loves a bit of hardship, I think, as well on the course.
Yeah, that's true. Whereas I don't think Larry does. I think if it goes badly for Lowry, he kind of self-destructs a bit and he can't get over a mistake he just made. But in terms of form, like, I wouldn't say he's a contender, Lowry, but he's definitely, out of the two lads that have representing us, you definitely lean towards Lowry.
Yeah. Right now I would, I'd be kind
of... Which I didn't think I'd say that a few weeks ago after McIlroy won the Masters. I thought he'd be set free. Now, in fairness, we've only seen, so one major since the PGA, which was fine. It was a bit of a non-event for McIlroy. He made the cut and I think he finished in one under, thereabouts. But not making the Canadian Open and then skipping the Jack Nicklaus event and then talking about feeling betrayed by the two journalists that leaked the info about the driver. It's all just stuff that I thought wouldn't really bother a guy who's finally done it all. But then again, he's climbed a mountain and he probably doesn't know how to get down now.
He's not normally, though, like in when he's been the other way, striving for it. And I think that's what McGinley's getting at. He's normally quite positive.
He is.
He's in there quoting Marcus Aurelius and whatever other thing he's got going on at the minute, like.
But that's what I mean.
I just don't think that's that mad a thing to say. Like, I don't think that's representative of any beef. Like,
I don't think. But I wouldn't say, I wouldn't go by body language as being very worrying. I would go by what literally McIlroy is saying, which is the two things is like, not happy with his game, particularly driving. The driving at the moment is atrocious. Like, very recently, but very bad as well. But he's also admitted that he lacks motivation. Now, I thought we'd be hearing that 2 years down the line, not 2 months down the line after the Masters. I thought he'd have an adrenaline surge and that he'd, I'm not saying he necessarily has to win the three other majors that happened this year after, but certainly be in contention in the final day. And it just hasn't been the case yet, but it is very early doors. Like, he could prove us all wrong again, which he does in spectacular fashion. And maybe this is his new motivation now, because he needs something. It was like, well, people are already writing me off on my body language. Now I'm going to come back a bit angrier this time around, perhaps. I don't know. So they'll tee off at 12:40 p.m. today, Irish time. The lads, along with Justin Rose, of course, who's McIlroy's buddy at the Masters in that playoff. And what else do we have then? So it's 12:29 p.m. This is all Irish time, of course. Xander Schauffele and Bryson DeChambeau in the same group. 6:25 p.m. Irish time, Victor Hovland, Colin Morikawa and Scottie Scheffler. That's fairly dynamic trio there. And then 12:18 p.m. Ludwig Åberg, Adam Scott, Hideki Matsuyama, and then we have, as I say, Lowry, Rose, McIlroy, 12:40, and then Jordan Spieth, John Rahm and Dustin Johnson is 6:14 p.m. So there's some seriously good trios here. As I say, Dustin Johnson is the last player to win this when it was played at Oakmont CC in 2016. We'll get more on the US Open with John Duggan around 8:55 a.m. as we preview what it starts today around lunchtime Irish time. I want to take you here to The Guardian, if you'll bear with me here. This is Thomas Tuchel, the England manager. It's not going well. Arthur called this. Not going well at the moment. England 1, Senegal 3. But the biggest news since then, Tuchel warns repulsive Jude Bellingham. Urged to turn fire on opposition and not teammates. Right? So, these are Tuchel's quotes about Jude Bellingham. It stems from his mother. Tuchel admitted his mother sometimes had mixed emotions when watching Bellingham play. But Tuchel wants him basically to harness that energy to the opposition. Jude has a certain something. He brings an edge which we welcome and which is needed if we want to achieve big things. The edge needs to be channeled towards the opponent, towards our goal, and not to intimidate teammates or to be over-aggressive towards teammates or referees. He has the fire. I don't want to dim this down, but the fire comes also with some attributes that can be intimidating, maybe even as a teammate. And you see sometimes the explosion towards referee and the anger in his game. If he can channel this in the right way and we can help him with this, then for sure he is something that we need. He has a certain edge that is hard to find. I'd say you could have said the exact same thing about Roy Keane.
I just thought it was so funny. It's like my mother said, I kind of read it. It was very like, I don't know, Irish mammy or something kind of vibes to it. And I was like, why was he saying that? Why was he telling the... I was like, did he realise he was talking to journalists? That's a conversation I think you have when you're sitting...
Yeah, this is on TalkSport. Thomas Tuchel said this. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, he's an honest guy. He's always been fairly transparent with his emotions. You're right. My mother was telling me. Yeah, it is. That was definitely an interesting element. But what draws me to it is that I think reading it, I could draw all these attributes to Roy Keane. Like, Roy Keane certainly intimidated his teammates.
Yeah.
Was certainly an intimidating figure to be around. Because if you did, it wasn't so much if he did something right with Roy Keane. If he did something wrong, you'd know all about it. And is that not what Bellingham has? What's the difference? Why do people see it as a negative with Bellingham?
Well, I don't know. He's only 21, isn't he?
Yeah, he's so young, yeah.
I think that's probably it.
Do you think so?
I think so. Because you were saying, like, so Roy Keane at 21 was just arriving at United and he wasn't that.
I don't even think he was, to be honest. Okay. I think he only got into the fire. He got into the fire team at 19.
Right. Yeah, you're probably right. So he was born in 71, 21. Wasn't he? So, yeah. So he's only going over. So, like, 22. He always talks... We hear him talk about it's always the other way. He's always talking about the guys above him. There's no way he was going in and shouting the odds at that point of his life.
No. But I guess, look, maybe it goes down to the lack of inspirational figures in dressing rooms. I mean, when Roy Keane was that age, he's probably roughly in his last year at Nottingham Forest. And even when he was at Forest over the years, he would have had like Stuart Pearce and Des Walker and guys he could just lean on. And then when he went to Manchester United, he had like Brian Robson and Gary Pallister and Steve Bruce. So he just followed their lead. Maybe Bellingham is actually a different character, but also going into the dressing room at Real Madrid and England and looking around and saying, I don't see anybody else is going to do this, so I'm going to have to do it myself.
Sure, that's nonsense. Like, because they got to like a Euro final with him there, and they got to, they've had their most successful thing post 66 in the years building up to his arrival. Like, you can't look at someone like Harry Kane and go, like, oh, you're not inspiring.
It kind of sounds like the whole school bus thing. It's like first year's at the front. The older you are, you get to sit further down the back. You're leaving cert, you get to sit in the back seat. And actually, if you're a young student and you sat in the back seat, the leaving cert would come down and be like, out. Like, is that what it is? Is it because he's young and they're kind of saying, well, now, come on now. Know your place.
I don't know. You see, I don't associate him with age at all because he carries himself with such maturity that he strikes me as someone in his late 20s. I'm always surprised when I hear Jude Bellingham's age.
Yeah, he
always
sounds a bit threatened nearly to Tuchel there. It's like, he doesn't feel like he has control over that dressing room. Why does he?
Do you think so? Do you think that? Did you get that from that?
Yeah.
Geez, I didn't. I thought Tuchel was just kind of just commenting at almost from the outside looking in. It was like, well, it doesn't affect me. It's the teammates that it affects. I can't imagine Tuchel being intimidated by Bellingham, but I could definitely see his possible concern that he is like that in teams. I guess with Bellingham is like they're a very different player to Roy Keane. Like, you know, Roy Keane would say himself that he had a certain limit to his natural ability as a footballer and he was very simple as a player, like touch and pass, obviously to extraordinary levels. Whereas I guess Bellingham was a bit more creative.
What do you think Jude Bellingham makes of Thomas Tuchel?
I'd say he respects him. Why? Because of his CV. Because the fact that he's won the Champions League.
Yeah, but he's won a Champions League.
Yeah, but I would say you're on my level.
Yeah, do you think so?
I think so, yeah. I think he would. I think Tuchel carries himself. Like, we have a very different opinion about Thomas Tuchel, you and I. I'm a big Tuchel fan. I think he carries himself with presence. I like the way he talks about the game, and I think he's had enough success to warrant getting big jobs. I thought it was like, you know, whatever about the nationality side of things. So I thought it was a good appointment by England, and I could see Bellingham certainly not walking all over him, certainly thinking like, yeah, the guy's achieved what I've achieved. But what I'm really trying to get out of this is why do people look at this as a negative with Bellingham, and they didn't necessarily look at it as a negative when it came to Roy Keane?
Well, because do positive stories not sell? I mean, they just look good to get people to grab people's attention. Like, it's funny because there's actually some scathing articles about Tuchel online, and like there's one in the Daily Mail where they compared him to Britney Spears' 55-hour marriage. So is he trying to... I actually might read...
Yeah, go for it, yeah.
The honeymoon lasted longer than the 55 hours Britney Spears stayed married to her one-time school friend Jason Alexander, but not by much. And the boos which chased Thomas Tuchel out of the city ground after England's lame defeat by Senegal were far louder than the boo-hoos which followed Britney to the divorce court from her boozy wedding in the fabled Little White Chapel on the Las Vegas Strip. And that was the opening two paragraphs. So is he trying to maybe get the heat off him a bit? Or is he kind of...
Well, look, that's definitely an interesting shout that he might be very political about the whole thing. But I'd say he was just asked about Bellingham and gave his opinion. Like, I find Bellingham a conundrum, and I seem to get into an awful lot of trouble when I say that. When I question what kind of a player he is, what does he do in games, it's like it's something you're not allowed to ask. I that's the feeling I get with Bellingham. I have no doubt about it. Unbelievable player. Like, Birmingham City retired his shirt number, which is ridiculous, when he left as a young fella, as a teenager. And he's very carefully picked his path. I mean, like, the Bellingham brothers have no time for the Premier League, it seems, at all. Because he turned it down, and then Job has left Sunderland just as they're promoted.
We need to come back to that one, because that's a strange move.
Do you think so? Job?
I've never heard of anyone doing that.
I actually texted our good buddy Jonathan Wilson, who's a Sunderland fan, and I was like, why do the Bellinghams hate the Premier League? And he was like, because the Bellinghams have been well looked after.
Yeah.
You know, so like, he is a good deal at Dortmund. And I guess, Jude, this goes back to the influential thing, and maybe how much of a presence he is could well have said to Job, don't bother struggling with Sunderland in the Premier League, go to Borussia Dortmund in the Bundesliga and have a better time for yourself. So look, I actually really admire how single-minded Jude Bellingham is completely, and he's very carefully chosen where he wants to go. But I still find him overall a conundrum when I really study him in games. Like, what is this guy actually doing in games that makes him imperative to every team he plays with? And it's not immediately obvious to me. Does that make sense?
There's a knock on. Like, it is interesting the way you're talking, because it does feel like, and this isn't related to Tuchel, more so the way he's just covered. Like, there's an inevitable thing of him being an incredibly confident young black man in England, who is kind of going about his business.
Oh, you
in
think
a way.
That?
Oh, I think it's the same thing that happens to Trent Alexander-Arnold as well. If, you know, I think there's no question about it that there's a little bit of that. And you see that. It permeates through in the media coverage a lot of time. And the way he is, as you're saying, so single-minded and more or less kind of in a similar way to almost the Haaland situation, where it's like has his whole career out in front of him, and he's going to do exactly what he wants.
Yeah.
And I think people find that it's very un-English. It's very un-English. Like Harry Kane, if you take Harry Kane, and there's no slight in Harry
Kane. Kane stayed longer than he should have.
Kane is literally, it's like, oh.
He's catching up now.
All right, okay.
Yeah.
So hang along.
Oh, look, definitely.
How long would Bellingham have stayed at Spurs?
6 months, get me out of here. This is not following my objectives. He's a LinkedIn footballer, Jude Bellingham. He updates you on how well he's doing. That's Jude Bellingham. But with... I need an answer to this question. Like, the difference between Roy Keane and Jude Bellingham is, like, I think Keane achieved so much at club level, and with his country, far lower expectations, in fairness. Far lower. Playing with inferior players, even though it was a good time for Irish football in hindsight, he was still the best player in the team probably most of the time with the Republic of Ireland. And so he was bringing everyone else up. Jude Bellingham is surrounded by very talented players at England, so maybe... People are very frustrated that England haven't won a major tournament, and they look at this guy and being like, he's running his mouth, and yet we're still not winning tournaments. So therefore, we're going to attack you. But in terms of the point about race and culture, that opens up a way wider discussion, which would mean that Jude Bellingham is not in control of that narrative whatsoever. Mm.
No, and I don't think so. But that's hard. It's a very hard topic. It'd be an interesting one. We should do that with someone who'll know more about it. But I always find it just, it's striking.
Yeah.
And, I think that there's probably a suspicion surrounding him. That it's like, but I don't think that's from, sorry, I can't clarify enough. I don't think that's what's motivating Tuchel's comments. I just think, but I do think, I suspect Tuchel is slightly intimidated. I think so.
Reporting 8 a.m. on Thursday morning's Off the Ball Breakfast. We'll get to Casement Park in just a second with you, Rachel. We'll read out some comments first. Dermot Keenan Cullum, check out the Luis Diaz goal for Colombia against Argentina in the World Cup qualifiers. Hope he stays at Liverpool. I haven't seen this yet, Dermot, but you're the second person who told me look out for Luis Diaz's goal. I'll try and watch it in the ad break here. Up the Rebels, says Palmer. Dermot Keane back again. Great to have Megan back, plus Rachel. Some burner accounts here, well up and running now. It's a lot of a lot of praise for Megan and Rachel this morning. Nice to have that praise ourselves, Arthur, wouldn't it? But there's loads of nice comments coming in here. And then in terms of the US Open, a lot of people are obviously naturally very interested in this. Shifty lad thinking that Justin Rose is an outsider for sure. And Dermot back again. Rory needs to sort out his driver and the rest of his game is fine. Drove the ball all over the shop like me at the Canadian Open. Caseman Park.
Caseman Park, yeah. Announcement yesterday that the UK government are putting £50 million towards it.
Okay. You were at this?
I was at a Women in Sport funding announcement yesterday. So in Sport Ireland, the Irish government announced that they're putting, it was record-breaking last year, 4 million. They're equaling that again, 4 million euro into Women in Sport funding in Ireland, which is incredible. It was a great event. To be fair, it was just like women from all different sports. Like we had surfing, diving, anything you could think of was there. But the both ministers for sport were there. And I talked to Charlie McConnell, the Minister for Sport and Postal Policy, about it just when the news had dropped about the UK investing that £50 million. And asked him, so that with that money, there's still about 106 million euro of a deficit before they have what they need. So I asked him the Irish government's position on that. Will they be willing to foot the bill?
Let's have a look.
Yeah, well, listen, that's very welcome. It's something the Irish government are very committed to, and that's why we've committed €50 million ourselves a few months ago, or last year, from the Shared Island Fund towards the development of Caseman Park. And I know it's a project the GAA will be looking to step out. I know the £50 million will be a really welcome commitment from the British government. It's something I know the GAA now will now, in terms of the funding commitment they have, as to how they can move forward with that. It's something the Irish government has supported from the outset and supported in terms of the funding commitment of €50 million that we've committed to it.
And it looks like there's about €106 million of a gap now that will be left before the amount is needed. Is there something that you'll be doing, talking with the GAA, talking with the UK government?
Yeah, well, listen, I mean, primarily now it's something for the GAA to consider in relation to the funding commitments and what is possible within that and how they can step the project forward. Certainly the Irish government wants to see the project proceed. We want to see Antrim have a home ground, but also Belfast have Caseman Park very much part of its sporting offering and a massive role in the history of the GAA in the island and in Ireland. We want to see it play a really important role of the GAA and the sport of Northern Ireland too. And that's why we put such a strong Irish government commitment we look to see how we can continue to support that now in terms of its development.
Yeah, apologies for the interrupted quality there, but hopefully you got the gist. Would you be positive on the back of that?
Yeah, it was shocking to hear him say that they really welcomed the money, you know, and I was hoping that he'd kind of say, yeah, we'll back that, but almost washed his hands with it and said, yeah, so that's the GAA's problem now. They want their pitch, let them find that 106 million euro. He said, obviously, Antrim and Ulster GAA needs a home up there, but did kind of really put the ball back in the GAA's court, saying, you've spearheaded this now, lads. Let's find the cash. Maybe go down to Mayo.
It's a story that just runs on forever. I think we're getting to the point when you mentioned the two words together, Caseman and Park. People sigh in Irish sport. Certainly a person who sighed was Stephen Bradley when it came to the Republic of Ireland job. It's unusual now that we would play two videos back to back at this stage of the show, folks, but do bear with us. I really do think this is worth playing. This is part of our Inner Drive series. Stephen Bradley sat down with Nathan Murphy. It's a genuinely, I know it's a biased opinion, a fantastic, genuinely insightful and tremendous chat. But Stephen Bradley revealed that he was asked if he was interested in the Republic of Ireland seniors job once upon a time, so had a meeting with the powers that be, or was supposed to have a meeting. Take a look at this.
Would I like to manage the senior national team of this country? Of course I would.
What happened around the Ireland job? Did you feel you had a chance? Were you approached at any stage?
Yeah, I was approached. I was approached through back channels at the start, asking, is it something that I would be interested in and having that conversation? Obviously, the answer was yes. A meeting was set up between myself and Mark Canham and Jonathan Hill. Unfortunately, both of Mark and Jonathan were late for the meeting, 15 minutes late, so I left.
Well, when he spoke to me about it, initially he said, you're going to kill me, like, you know. And I said, well, he said, I came off the call. And I said, right, why? He said, they left me waiting whatever amount of time was. And I thought, good. That's how I felt, really, as I thought. And it's not an arrogance, it's respect, like, you know. I think they wouldn't leave Jose Mourinho waiting 10 minutes. So either you're there on merit and they respect you the same as everyone else, or they don't.
That probably summed up how serious the interest was for me to have the job, which I found disrespectful and not good enough, to be honest with you. If I was someone that they were really serious about having that job, they would not have been late for that meeting.
So he's no less valued than anyone else, so I think it was the right thing to do.
Megan?
Well, I have to say, so I am an incredibly punctual person. In fact, I'm always early. And if anyone ever is late, I'm like, this is my time and your time. And if you're wasting my time, it means you do not have respect for me. So that is something that's a real bugbear of mine.
You went for the Ireland job as well, right? Yeah.
Yeah, they actually left me waiting 20 minutes. I actually had a Zoom call yesterday, and after 5 minutes, they weren't getting on. And I was like, do I hang up? And it was like a pretty important meeting.
Yeah, yeah.
And I said, oh, what's the... So I text and I was like, well, do I wait a bit longer? And I was like, I think 10 minutes for me was going to be the period. And the next minute they came on and I was like, oh, great. And they're like, look, sorry for the delay. But I think 15 minutes, like that is too long. Like if they said, all you do is send a WhatsApp saying, so sorry, running late, we'll be with you soon. That for me just screams lack of respect.
Is it too much pride, Rachel, though? If he did hang on and he had that chat with the now, of course, the departed Mark Hannan from the role and Jonathan Hill.
From the role,
clarify. if he had hung on, would we be talking about a very different trajectory for Stephen Bradley, or was he right?
It's a know-your-worth situation, really, isn't it? Now, I would have probably been on that call for hours.
Still there now.
Have the phone here just in case.
Hey guys, just on the call, whenever you're free.
Yeah, you're the only one left in the group chat.
Yeah.
But no, I mean, well, 15 minutes, you know yourself, you can have a lot. We're having technical issues there, the file not working properly.
Yeah.
I would have given it 20, 25.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Wow.
Because of what's on offer?
Because of what's at stake, yeah.
That's interesting. So you have a stock market approach to Zoom, what's up and what's down. I'll go by what's demanded.
If you felt that respect maybe running into it,
yeah,
and you had a gut feeling,
yeah, yeah,
fair enough. But if it was... God, we really think you're right for this role. And it was just a 15-minute difference in a Zoom call.
They wouldn't have waited 10 minutes. I wouldn't have had Jose Mourinho wait for 10 minutes, Arthur.
Yeah, they wouldn't. But, I mean, to be fair, they're probably going to fly to Jose Mourinho. But he's not doing the Zoom call for it. This was post-Kenny.
I don't know the exact timeline.
I suppose it must have been.
But it wouldn't have been the time Kenny got the job. It was a long time ago.
I think it's fine. I think he's right in the term that they probably weren't serious about it.
Yeah.
I don't think, and it's no reflection on him, I just don't think after the Kenny situation that hiring another League of Ireland manager was ever going to fly, the way these things tend to go. Mm. It kind of, you know, goes McCarthy, it goes Kerr, it goes Staunton. It goes, you know, it kind of happens every 10, 15 years. So I don't think that was ever going to happen. So I suspect he knew that doing that, because I think Rachel's bang on. It's like if you had a realistic chance, a realistic hope that this job was on the line, you're not leaving it out. You're not leaving without like a WhatsApp, a message. It's like, what if he got the time wrong? Like there's too many variables that I think he knew. I suspect he knew that it wasn't. He wasn't coming out of this with the job.
If there was a relationship already built, you'd give him a quarter of an hour grace.
You would.
Yeah.
But he probably was suspicious all along that they didn't really want them in the first place.
Yeah,
but
it sounds like he had a good feeling.
It is interesting. Do let us know. I'd be very interested to hear people's opinions on this on YouTube. Should Stephen Bradley have hung on for that call or not? And what is the grace period time? What is it for people?
10 minutes.
5 minutes, 10 minutes, 15 minutes, 1 minute, an hour, or 4 months here, as Rachel would say.